This is Unanimous Dissent, broadcasting from the Radio Sputnik studios in Washington, D.C. We're the District Sentinel. I'm Sam Sachs.
I'm Sam Knight. Coming up, we take a deep dive into the Clinton Foundation State Department pay-to-play allegations. International Business Times reporter David Sirota joins us to talk about his latest findings.
Yeah, and it's going to be an extended interview. David has done a lot of really good reporting on this issue, so stick around for that. But first, we've got about 2.5 months to go until the election, the presidential election in November. And given that the Clinton campaign decided to up its own rhetoric to match Trump last week, it looks like it's just going to be the two candidates calling each other bigots and racists for the next 11 weeks. In fact, here's a little preview of what's to come.
Hillary Clinton is a bigot.
A steady stream of bigotry coming from him.
She's going to do nothing for African Americans.
It's the textbook definition of a racist comment.
You're racist.
This is someone who retweets white supremacists.
You're racist.
These are racist ideas, race baiting ideas.
Okay, you get the picture. Now, my question is, who do you think benefits from this? Who benefits from days and days and days of Clinton and Trump each calling each other bigots and racists, regardless of the fact that Trump
is obviously without question racist?
Yes, or at least plays to these racist tendencies in America, or, you know, plays, you know, speaks the language of racism. In fact, he has his own problems with the Department of Justice investigating how he was a racist when he was renting out apartments to African-American tenants. But Clinton is not going to benefit if this is the way this election is going to go for the next 2.5 months. She's way ahead already in the polls. And this election has become a referendum on Donald Trump instead of her, which is exactly what her campaign should want. But by deciding to get in the gutter with Trump right now, Clinton runs the risk of depressing voter turnout, or at least voter trust that the political system can be fixed. And when voters don't want to participate, when they think that no matter what they do, it's not going to solve anything, those are electoral sentiments that tend to benefit Republicans at the polls. Researchers at Rutgers and George Washington University studied this topic a few years ago, and although they couldn't find a clear, discernible impact on voter turnout, they concluded that negative campaigning has the potential to do damage to the political system itself, as it tends to reduce feelings of political efficacy, trust in government, and perhaps even satisfaction with the government itself. So if there's any way at all that Clinton can let Trump back into this thing, it's by doing her part to poison the political debate.
Yeah. Yeah. Clinton could be out there campaigning with down-ballot Democrats. Remember during the waning days of the Democratic primary, when you had Clinton supporters and Clinton-friendly pundits raging that Bernie wasn't helping down-ballot Democrats?
Oh, yeah, and we're going to get into that here in a second.
Okay, yeah, not just making sure that that is something that everyone remembers.
Yeah.
Yeah, she could be doing that. She could be promoting policies that could turn out Democratic voters all up and down the ticket, running against wildly unpopular Congress.
Yeah.
And the most unpopular, you know, nominee they've had in history.
Yeah, instead, she's name-dropping Alex Jones and talking about the alt-right and trying to make the argument that Donald Trump is some unique racist within the Republican Party.
Yeah, by the way, the alt-right were really giddy about Clinton's speech.
I'm sure.
That was like, yeah, I'll just read this New York Times headline. It said it all. Hillary Clinton denounces the alt-right, and the alt-right is thrilled. The alt-right was trending on Twitter after the speech, by the way, and sordid figures from the fringe movement were falling all over themselves to define what it means. What does it mean to be alt-right right now? Well, they had the opportunity and they ran with it.
Yeah. Now that the mainstream media is paying attention and asking all these questions about the alt-right
now. And of course, you know, they're going to ask the right questions because or the mainstream media, and that's what they do.
Yes, ask the right questions. The Times noted that Mrs. Clinton's public criticism of the alt-right could turn out to be a boon for the movement, and its members did their best to capitalize on the moment. So, again, look at how quickly things escalated after Clinton's Reno speech last week, and consider that we've got like 70 days of this stuff left. And tell me who at the end of it all is going to want to vote for either candidate, or who might just say, hey, I'm going to go vote for third party candidate. I can't deal with either of them. And as polling has already shown, Jill Stein and Gary Johnson, the Green Party and Libertarian nominees, they're pulling voters more from the Clinton camp than they are from the Trump camp. So the last thing Clinton wants to do is give them more reason to leave by trying to sling as much mud as Trump, which I can tell you right now, she can't sling as much mud as Trump. I mean, look at what happened during the GOP primary when Marco Rubio and all these other guys tried to play Trump's game.
Yeah. They
were ridiculed.
Yeah.
But also, and this is, I think, a more important point and something that Sam Knight was getting to here, Clinton's speech last week actually wounded down ballot Democrats, the very people that she and her surrogates claimed would be aided most by a Clinton nomination as opposed to a Sanders nomination. You remember these proxy wars during the primary that Sanders is not going to help down ballot candidates. People are going to be wary about supporting him, whereas Clinton, a true blue Democrat, is going to help all these true blue Democrats down the ballot.
Yeah, Sanders is not even a Democrat. He's not even a Democrat, you guys. Did you know he's not a Democrat?
Here's what I'm talking about, and it's similar to an argument I made about the speech last week, only now I've got some proof to back up my claims that I was making. Normally, I'm just spouting things off here. Clinton did Republicans a huge favor by distinguishing them from the Trump wing of the party, which she called the alt-right, rather than painting Republicans, all Republican lawmakers, as part of the Trump wing. She's essentially giving down ballot Republicans cover to tell voters who are repulsed by Trump, hey, I'm not like that guy, Trump. I'm a responsible Republican. I'm one of the good Republicans that Hillary Clinton was talking about in her speech, not one of the racist Republicans. And it fits. It makes sense that Clinton gave this speech because it's been widely reported that the Clinton campaign is actively trying to fundraise with Republicans, trying to tap into Mitt Romney's donor network. But it comes at the expense of Democrats' chances of taking back the House and Senate in November. The best way Democrats can make big congressional gains in November is by casting their Republican opponents as Trumpers as well. But the Clinton campaign just, for some reason, undercut that last week. And this isn't just leftist Sam spewing complaints about Clinton's campaign strategy. Trust me, I've got many complaints about Clinton's campaign strategy. I talk about him a lot, but I'm not the only one making this particular argument. I'm actually parroting the concerns of the actual Democratic National Committee, which pleaded with Hillary Clinton not to embark on this strategy. The Hill, the Capitol Hill newspaper outlet known as The Hill, flagged a couple emails from the DNC email hack that had been previously reported on, but take on some more meaning now in light of Clinton's alt-right speech in Reno last week, when she praised the likes of John McCain and George W. Bush and Bob Dole as being the good Republicans versus the bad Republicans like Donald Trump. And in one of these emails, DNC communication director Luis Miranda, who resigned recently because of how he was portrayed as favoring Clinton over Sanders during the primary in these leaked emails. Anyways, he's writing an email complaining about the Clinton strategy, which was to convey that Trump is much worse than regular Republicans. And Miranda writes that this strategy is a problem for us referring to the DNC, which is working to elect down ballot Democrats in congressional races as well. And here's why Miranda sees it as a problem. He writes, quote, "We would basically have to throw out our entire frame that the GOP made Trump through years of divisive and ugly politics. It just doesn't work from the party side. He also adds that this strategy, this Clinton strategy of driving a wedge of portraying certain Republicans as good and some as bad, he adds that that would also put us at odds with basically all of our congressional Democrats who have embraced our talking points to point out that GOPers in Congress have been pushing these ugly policies for years.
Do you remember when Antonin Scalia was still alive?
I do, just barely now, though.
Right?
It's been such a world-changing event here. I haven't been so happy.
Right? I mean, apart from all the happy Disney forest animals that have been skipping around inexplicably for months since he died, you know, I don't really remember what life was like before. Fortunately, however, we covered this in the Sentinel. When Scalia was alive in late 2015, he basically railed against affirmative action, saying that blacks were inferior.
Yeah.
Everyone
this
remembers
that. This was like
that.
A year ago.
Less than a year ago.
Yeah.
Harry Reid, the Senate Minority Leader, top Democrat in Congress, responded to that by saying, among other things, quote, "The only difference between the ideas endorsed by Trump and Scalia is that Scalia has a robe and a lifetime appointment. Ideas like this don't belong on the internet, let alone the mouths of national figures." So,
yeah,
I
doubt that Clinton would call Scalia the alt-right either.
Right, right. I remember watching that and thinking, wow, Harry Reid, you know, a lot of times he says dumb stuff, but yeah, I thought he hit it out of the park there. And, it was good messaging, and now it's all being torn to tatters by Clinton.
Yeah, and you could really replace Scalia with any number of Republicans who've served in Congress over the last few decades and spewed a lot of these retrograde ideas and pushed a lot of these bad racist policies. So we got the DNC writing emails to the Clinton campaign saying, don't do this. Don't embark on this strategy. It's going to hurt down ballot Democrats. Well, the Clinton campaign obviously didn't care about those concerns, which is strange, again, because all we heard during the primary was how she'd be the best candidate to help Democrats take back the House and the Senate. So again, I'm not sure how calling Trump a racist and a bigot over and over again and claiming that he's alone in the Republican Party that acts this way is either going to help her in the short term or help down-ballot Democrats either. Again, this race is not even close right now. There's no need for Clinton to do any of this. There is no upside. It's not like if enough Republicans come on board to help her win in November, that they're going to be there after November, starting next year in Congress, willing to play ball with her on getting her agenda passed. They won't be. Anyone think that Jeff Flake or Mark Kirk or any of these other Republican never Trumpers would help Clinton pass an increase to the federal minimum wage? No. What about, you think they'll support Clinton's idea for tuition assistance at public colleges? No. Are they going to support paid family sick leave proposals? No. They're not going to support any of that.
They might support
TPP.
TPP, proposals to bomb countries.
Corporate tax reform.
The tripling of Israel's military budget and nuclear.
Change CPI.
Yeah, all those things.
So assuming that's not what those stuff aren't what Clinton's goal is, even though
probably
some of that is, this strategy she's using here is not going to help her. In fact, it hurts her. I mean, as Sam Knight reminded me last week, Clinton has racist skeletons in her own closet, ones that the Trump campaign has now opened the door to in response to Clinton's attacks that he's a racist. Trump's got a new ad out that references Clinton's super predators remarks. Remember, that's the stuff she said back in when she was the first lady and the crime bill was being passed by her husband. The new Trump ad also references the Clinton campaign's 2008 tactics against Barack Obama that were widely criticized as examples of dog whistle racism. So anyone could see that these counterattacks were coming. I mean, Clinton had to answer a lot of these questions during the primary. And now they're coming back again. And for me, this is just more confirmation that the Clinton campaign is run by people who aren't very good at strategy, people who aren't very good at their jobs and seeing what's in front of them in the political environment that they have to react to.
But I thought she was the most qualified candidate ever.
Well,
literally in the history of political candidates.
Yeah.
She just no one. no one had as many qualifications.
Yeah. The other thing here is that reporters are doing a pretty good job of exposing how awful Trump is every day in newspapers and on TV, meaning that Clinton doesn't have to do the heavy lifting here. Again, she can go get lost for the next 2.5 months or go around to each state or each Democrat who's running in a key Senate seat and try and help them win. She doesn't need to be going out there and engaging in face-to-face or at least split screen on TV, Trump versus Clinton, you're a racist, you're a racist, you're a bigot, you're a bigot.
I mean, everyone knows that Trump is like very obviously racist.
Remember the USA Today investigation, which found hundreds of people, carpenters, dishwashers, painters, lawyers, who Trump stiffed, refused to pay them for their services? We're talking about small businesses, average Americans that Trump personally screwed. But this story has been lost a bit because the Clinton campaign would rather hype up Trump's unique racism or his ties to the Kremlin. Look, we're going to see how this plays out. I still think that despite these missteps, Clinton has a very good shot of winning in November, and Democrats still have a good chance of taking back the Senate. But if they come up short, even if Hillary Clinton wins, but Democrats don't do as well in congressional races, I will guarantee you that the first thing that liberal Clinton supporters will do is blame Bernie Sanders and the Bernie bros for not doing more to get Democrats elected in November. And we now know that that will be complete rubbish. We'll be able to point at these DNC emails with DNC officials raising precisely these concerns with the Clinton campaign strategy to rehabilitate Republicans in order to defeat Donald Trump. And we'll say, this is one of the reasons why down ballot Democrats were hurt this election. Stay tuned. More Unanimous Dissent coming up. And welcome back to Unanimous Dissent. The two Sams are still here with you, still broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Sam, take it away.
Last week, the country turned its attention back to the Clinton Foundation as emails from Clinton's private email server brought up more and more questions about the organization's work while she was Secretary of State. Released amid a FOIA lawsuit filed by a conservative watchdog, the documents showed, for example, Foundation officials badgered Clinton's staff in 2009 to arrange a sit-down with Bahrain's military leader, Crown Prince Salman, and arrange one they did. In the years that followed, Clinton signed off on increases in arms sales to Bahraini forces. Salman, meanwhile, helped raise $32 million for the Clinton Foundation, and the government of Bahrain donated $100,000 on top of that. Oh, and by the way, the oil-rich monarchy used some of its newfound strength in 2011 to violently suppress peaceful demonstrations. Predictably, Clinton and many of her supporters are reacting indignantly to this story, as if it's just the most normal thing in the world for a Secretary of State to run a private foundation that accepts money from businesses and foreign governments she has been tasked with regulating. James Carville, the political strategist, elite advisor, and close ally for years to the Clintons, for example, said that critics of the foundation are literally murderers. Somebody is going to hell over this, he said. This is saving people's lives. Joining us now to discuss the matter of the Clinton Foundation is a guy who's done a lot of reporting on it, David Sirota. David is the International Business Times Senior Editor of Investigations, and he is joining us now via Skype. Welcome, David.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Hey, David, I want to start. You have an article up over at the International Business Times that kind of runs down the list of what we've learned so far about the Clinton Foundation and the State Department. And this goes beyond just the latest emails that have come out. It dates back a few years and what other outlets have reported on, and including what you yourself have reported on. Of all this stuff that's come out to this point, what do you think are a couple of the most problematic things we've learned in terms of this relationship between the foundation and the State Department while Clinton was there?
Well, I mean, in general, we've learned, and I don't think this is in any dispute, we've learned that the Clinton Foundation had donors with major business before the State Department. And we know in many cases, the business that those donors had before the State Department benefited from State Department policy. I mean, that's not a secret. That's something that we know has happened. The you know, there's many examples of this. We did a big series on arms exports. The State Department is the chief regulator of arms exports. A lot of people don't know that. Under federal law, the State Department does that, both government-to-government arms deals and also direct commercial arms deals where U.S. Arms exporters send or sell weapons to foreign governments. The State Department licenses those. And what we know is that many of the foreign governments that donated to the Clinton Foundation saw huge increases in their arms export approvals from the State Department. So we compared what was going on in the Bush administration with what was going on under Hillary Clinton-led State Department, and those were huge increases. You mentioned there was an email that came out about the Bahrain Crown Prince. The email, the recent email that came out showed that the Clinton Foundation reached out to the Secretary of State's office on behalf of the Bahraini Crown Prince, who was the number two in command of that country's military, and said that they wanted him to have a meeting with Hillary Clinton, and that an initial inquiry by the Crown Prince for that meeting had been rebuffed by Clinton, but that the foundation officials said that he was a good friend to us, the Crown Prince they're referring to, and the meeting was subsequently forged. The Crown Prince and Bahrain was a big donor to the Clinton Foundation and subsequently got huge arms export authorization increases from the Clinton-led State Department, 187% increase. At a time when subsequently Bahrain, as you mentioned, put down the Arab Spring uprisings and was accused of human rights violations. That's one example, but there are plenty of examples. I mean, there's an example of Clinton promoting Boeing's interests abroad, and then Boeing putting money into the Clinton Foundation after a key airplane deal with Russia. There was a story in the New York Times about how donors to the Clinton Foundation had interests in a transaction regarding a Russian state agency buying up a uranium business. The business had uranium locations in the United States, also had to get approval from the Clinton-led State Department as part of a multi-agency process to allow that transaction. We have written about how oil companies that had donated big to the Clinton Foundation were lobbying Hillary Clinton's State Department for, and successfully so, for the approval of a giant tar sands oil pipeline called the Alberta Clipper. And of course, there was the Wall Street Journal story about how Hillary Clinton intervened personally in a tax case in which the IRS was, as part of an investigation of the Swiss bank UBS, was demanding a certain large number of records as part of that investigation. Clinton intervened, which ended up reducing the amount of records that the Swiss bank had to turn over. And that Swiss bank subsequently significantly boosted its contributions to the Clinton Foundation. So those are some of them. There's plenty more. But I go back to what we know. We know that major donors to the Clinton Foundation had major business with the Clinton State Department. And we know that in many instances, that business, the decisions that the State Department made, were very favorable to those Clinton Foundation donors. Do we have a piece of paper that says this money to the Clinton Foundation is for exactly this favor? I have not seen that. But, you know, I've heard critics say, well, if there's no quid pro quo, then there's nothing wrong with that. You know, that is the argument of the Citizens United case, which is kind of ironic. The Democratic Party has said it's against the Citizens United idea. But the argument behind it is that basically that corruption doesn't exist unless you have explicit proof of a quid pro quo, that piece of paper that says this money is for this favor. Of course, we used to live in a country where the standard was, or the kind of principle was, you want to avoid appearances and potentials for conflict of interest, because you understand that if the potential exists, it can be operationalized in infinite number of ways that the public can't see and would never be able to see. That principle is under assault right now.
It's funny you mentioned the quid pro quo thing. I just watched panel discussion with you and Michael Cohen on The Speech Boy on Chris Hayes' show. And I, you know, I won't ask you to comment directly on The Speech Boy, but it was funny. What was funny to me was that he was saying that there was no, you know, no evidence of any sort of quid pro quo. But by the same token, you had foundation officials setting up a meeting on behalf of a foreign official. And the fact that that in and of itself isn't, you know, a cause for concern for liberal pundits, to me, is just
still, it's still access.
It's astonishing. Yeah, it's still something that they're getting.
I mean, look, it's the defense is incredible. I mean, I want to be clear. I'm a journalist. I'm not saying whether the foundation should be shut down or not shut down, whether it violated laws or not violated laws. I'm not making a value judgment.
Right.
But the defense that there's no evidence here that raises any questions at all. The underlying principle of making that argument is huge shift in the way that Democratic pundits, the Democratic Party, sort of the left side of the political world views the idea of corruption. It used to be, and Lee Fong at The Intercept has a great piece up today about how the Media Matters, a Clinton-affiliated media watchdog group, had previously criticized the Republicans for arguing that in the debates over campaign finance that corruption doesn't exist unless there is an explicit quid pro quo. Again, that is the explicit undergirding principle of Citizens United. If you are arguing that there is no evidence to raise any questions about the Clinton Foundation in terms of conflicts of interest and questions of corruption, you are effectively arguing, you are making Mitch McConnell's argument that there is no such thing as corruption unless money comes with an explicit directive that it is explicitly for a specific favor. When in fact, we all know, anybody who's worked in politics or worked around politics, covered it, we all know that the way influence works in politics is through relationships, through access, through being in the same circles, and that money, in many cases, creates and forges those relationships.
What's interesting is that even during her nomination hearing in 2009, Clinton addressed concerns about Hillary Clinton addressed concerns about the Clinton Foundation, and she referenced this agreement that had been worked out with the Obama administration on how the Clinton Foundation would be handled, and she explicitly said so that there wouldn't even be an appearance of corruption in her testimony before Congress. What exactly was this agreement, and was it violated, or just was it not worth a damn, considering that here we are now with all these examples of an appearance of corruption?
Well, look, I think the memorandum of understanding was designed, at least rhetorically, to try to create a firewall between the State Department and the Clinton Foundation. That firewall, in many cases, didn't seem to exist. You know, these emails were foundation officials directly reaching out to the State Department. Your point about this idea of appearances of conflict of interest. You know, I'm fascinated by this idea that the defense among many pundits in the Clinton campaign is that, you know, it's only optics and therefore it's not a big deal. Let's take that argument at its word just for a second. Let's just say, for argument's sake, that things just look bad, but nothing bad actually happened. The optics are important. If you're living in a democracy, the optics are connected to whether people feel like they can have faith that government decisions are being made fairly and impartially. And so this notion that the optics don't matter is a pretty radical idea, because the optics are about sowing public confidence in decisions that are being made by their government. It's fascinating to me that has become an argument in defense, an argument in defense is things look bad, but it's not really bad. And so people asking questions are bad because they're only focused on the optics, as if the optics do not matter.
It got me thinking this point about two recent sort of Supreme Court decisions. One, the one striking down the conviction of the Virginia governor, Bob McDonnell, saying that they needed proof of explicit quid pro quo. And yet there was also another decision about a capital case in Pennsylvania where they said that a judge who was a prosecutor when approving, you know, pursuing the death penalty, and then later became a Pennsylvania state Supreme Court justice, he could not rule on his case as a Supreme Court justice because of his prior involvement in the case, and that the mere appearance of a conflict of interest was unacceptable even to the Supreme Court, even in this age of, you know, I know they're not really exactly tied, but, you know, in the post-Citizens United age of just being okay with influence. That was interesting to me.
The parameters of what should be allowed and what isn't allowed. I mean, and let me step back and say, you know, what is convictable, actionable, prosecutable? That's a different standard than what is
right.
People look at and say that's concerning, that, and that's newsworthy. I would say this: all of the things that have been reported about the Clinton Foundation are newsworthy. I'm not making a judgment on whether they're concerning or not. That's for the public to decide. The Clinton campaign, they've attacked the AP, for instance, and the like. They are arguing not only is what they did legal, which is a different argument, but they are arguing it is not even of note or newsworthy. And I think that, to me as a journalist, I find that to be a dangerous concept. I do have an opinion on that. All of these things are newsworthy, whether it's Trump and him giving contributions to a Christie-linked group that, and then got a $25 million reduction of his taxes, or the Clinton Foundation questions. All of these things are certainly newsworthy and worthy of scrutiny. And I think you're seeing a trend right now where there is an attack not just on the conclusions, people's conclusions about what this reporting means, but actually an attack on the idea that it should even be reported. And I find that, frankly, to be incredibly radical and incredibly offensive as a journalist, because it's our job to bring out as much information about these candidates, all of these candidates, as possible. And you now have a situation where you have, by the way, both campaigns, Trump and Clinton, issuing attacks on the media itself. And I'm not a big defender of how the media has covered this campaign. I think there's been not enough substantive coverage. But basically, the Trump and Clinton campaign, in their own ways, have also attacked the idea of the media scrutinizing them, that is not legitimate. And that is a real problem.
I want to turn now to sort of what the foundation actually does. Foundation money, at least in one example we can point to, in one case, it went to longtime Clinton supporter Sidney Blumenthal, who received $10,000 a month from the organization for work he did for them. Is it fair to question the extent to which the foundation serves as sort of a support and professional network for Clinton loyalists?
I would say that there have been questions about how the foundation has spent its money, but let's set them aside for a sec and say, you know, for argument's sake, let's say the foundation largely does or nearly perfectly does altruistic good works. And there have been questions about that, but just for purposes of argument, sure. And I want to stipulate that there certainly is a lot of evidence that a lot of their programs do good work.
Yeah.
But the idea that the Clintons and the Clinton world gets nothing out of that is absurd on its face. And I'm not saying it's even bad that they get something out of it. Okay, they get something out of it. You know, Bill Clinton gets to jet set around the world, creates a political profile for the Clinton family, creates political and employment opportunities for friends of the Clintons who then help their campaign. I mean, the Clintons get a lot out of that foundation. And I'm not even begrudging them for getting a lot out of it. That's fine. That's how it works. But the notion to dispute that they get anything out of it is to then remove a truth from how to understand how it fits into people who are moonlighting, for instance, as the Secretary of State. In other words, if you can accept the idea that the Clintons get something, if not a lot, out of the Clinton Foundation for their own political profile and political empire, then you have to accept that the Clinton Foundation presents a potential conflict of interest when it is getting funded by businesses and foreign governments that simultaneously have business with the Clinton-led State Department. When the Clinton Foundation is asking a donor for money, and simultaneously that donor is in front of Secretary of State Clinton asking her for something, that creates the potential for a conflict. It creates the potential where the public official cannot be impartial.
More with David Sirota coming up after this break. Unanimous Dissent still here with you, still broadcasting out of the Radio Sputnik studios in Washington, D.C. I'm Sam Sachs, joined by Sam Knight. We're the District Sentinel news team, and you can read all of our latest reports over at www.districtsentinel.com. Now we continue with our interview with senior editor at the International Business Times, David Sirota. David, I've seen the Clinton Foundation put out, and supporters of the foundation put out a lot of information about what it's doing and the projects it's working on. I've also seen others who say they worked at the foundation or know people that worked at the foundation or are familiar with the projects kind of present a different light of what's going on at the foundation. There seems to be somewhat of a dearth of reporting about what exactly the Clinton Foundation is up to all around the world and how successful its projects have been. Do you agree with that, or do you think there is a lot of information, and why might there be this lack of reporting on to kind of hold the foundation accountable on its promises?
Well, look, there hasn't been nearly as much reporting on what the foundation does, and certainly I think more reporting would be useful. I mean, frankly, there's not a lot of substantive investigative reporting being done generally in the United States right now. So, I mean, yes, it would be good to know a little bit more about what that foundation has done, how successful it's been. I mean, there have been some questions about the Clintons' involvement in Haiti that have been raised. I don't think it's a conspiracy to suppress things on behalf of the media's conspiracy to not cover the Clinton Foundation. I certainly agree with you that there should be more. But again, I go back to the idea that even if you stipulate that 100% of what the Clinton Foundation did was incredibly successful and wonderful, the notion promoted, for instance, by James Carville, that people who question the potential conflicts and the ethics surrounding the Clinton Foundation are effectively against the good works that the Clinton Foundation does, that is a grotesque argument. It is grotesque to claim that journalists who are asking questions about potential conflicts of interest are either motivated by or resulting in, let's say, depriving HIV-stricken children, depriving them of medicine. That is a grotesque assertion. It's obviously an effort at political spin. I don't think it's, frankly, very convincing. I don't think anybody who hears that thinks it's very convincing. But, of course, it's certainly a political calculation, right? I mean, the Clintons want to bypass the legitimate ethical questions that have been raised by saying anybody who ask those questions effectively hates poor children. And I think the flipped part of that question is, when you look at the donors, is what did these donors think that they were getting? These are politically sophisticated donors. These are not stupid people. Foreign governments, corporations, they give money, and I have heard nobody, and I'd certainly love to hear somebody try to make this argument, but I've heard nobody argue that Saudi dictators who behead people are giving money to the Clinton Foundation because they genuinely, in the depth of their own heart, really care about poor kids. Nobody I've heard make that argument. Most people would likely assume that you give money to a politician's foundation, their family foundation, because you expect something in return. Did you get something in return? Was your money exclusively responsible for whatever you got in return? We don't know that. But we know these donors are smart. We know they're not in the business of throwing away money. The question is James Carville and all these people, are they really arguing that all these foreign governments and the like gave money to the Clinton Foundation just out of pure altruism? And if they're not, they're inherently acknowledging the potential and the possibility that there were some questions that need to be raised here.
The most glaring example undercutting James Carville's argument is the fact that Donald Trump gave to the Clinton Foundation, and he's frequently bragged about the reason why he gives money, and that is to politicians and other things, and that is to get things in return. Or maybe he's just some altruistic guy who wants to solve all the world's problems, but that doesn't jive with what the Clinton campaign is making him out to be.
I wonder if the underlying argument is, look, if we can get any kind of rich people, regardless of who they are, what they represent, to give us money, and we can turn that into good works, that is a victory. I mean, that would be an interesting argument. I haven't heard it articulated in that way. But I would also say it still doesn't negate the idea of that scrutiny should be there, and that there have been some real ethical questions raised. It is not a convincing argument to say, yes, there were these ethical questions. Yes, those fact-based questions are legitimate, and they in some cases appear to be problematic in terms of violating the memorandum of understanding, et cetera, et cetera. But that's okay, because what the Clinton Foundation does is good. That is not a standard through which we typically are supposed to operate. I mean, there is supposed to be such a thing as what's known as the rule of law. You can be doing great things, but if you're doing them in an ethically or legally questionable way, and again, I'm not saying that laws are broken, but in the abstract, if that's the case, the questions about the legality and the ethics are still worthwhile and important to raise, even if you can stipulate that what you're doing is a good thing, if the ultimate result of what you did is good.
I want to turn now briefly from the conflict of interest point. This is from a Guardian article about a 2012 speech Secretary Clinton gave on fighting AIDS and HIV. While Clinton was enthusiastically received by most of her audience, she had at first to speak over noisy protesters demonstrating against a U.S. trade agreement with Pacific countries that they say will restrict the production and availability of cheap generic AIDS drugs. Doctors Without Borders later said in a statement that it applauded the U.S. commitment to fighting AIDS, quote, but we also need the U.S. pledge to do no harm with its trade policies. And then briefly, there's this from an Oxfam media briefing on the speech. Less than a year after U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton shared her vision of the end of AIDS, the entirety of the U.S. government is failing to support this goal. Notably, U.S. trade policy is at odds with the goal of ensuring access to affordable AIDS medicine for people everywhere. So my question is this: for all the talk about the foundation doing amazing life-saving charity work and, you know, assume that it's true, does it give Clinton political cover now personally to basically advocate for life-threatening policies such as stringent rules on intellectual property of medicine?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, look, certainly the public official and the public policies they govern are more powerful than anything typically that an individual foundation does. In other words, a trade deal that has a more consumer-friendly patent rules on medicine is a much more powerful way, arguably, to help lots of people get the medicines they need than anything any single foundation could do, especially when you're talking about the U.S. government, which is so powerful. Look, I think that the acts of the Clinton Foundation that they've done, the programs and the like that are good and have had success, they will certainly provide a talking point for the Clintons and if Hillary Clinton is president, President Clinton to talk about and play off of. Just like I should add that there's this argument that donors to the Clinton Foundation were effectively buying themselves good PR. I mean, that was made when I was on MSNBC. That was the suggestion that, oh, well, the Saudis may have just given not for arms deals or the like, but to burnish their international image. But I think this all goes back to something important, which is that the Clinton Foundation inherently is, if that's the case, this PR idea is inherently a way for donors to tie themselves to a former U.S. president and, at the time she was Secretary of State, the sitting Secretary of State. And in a sense, that is effectively the office of the presidency and the office of the Secretary of State. And so if you are allowing people or corporations and foreign governments to spend money to effectively buy an affiliation with those offices, I mean, that is something of value. Is it illegal? I don't think it's illegal. Is it something that's worth scrutinizing and thinking about what that means and what it says about the kind of culture that a President Clinton would establish if she was president? Yeah, I think it's very worthwhile for people to think about, because, you know, that PR, if you're a country that's violating human rights and you put money into the Clinton Foundation and you get to affiliate yourself effectively at conferences and the like with the sitting Secretary of State, I mean, that has a lot of value. That has a lot of public policy value to you.
I wanted to say quickly on the point of the Saudis allegedly using this to burnish their PR, to paraphrase Michael Cohen, is that it's dangerous. We've seen them do that in the opposite way with money, when they threatened to defund United Nations programs recently, when the UN was threatening to put the Saudi government on a list of militaries that kill children for everything it's done in Yemen.
I want to make one more point about the Saudi question, because that has come up a lot in our reporting. And the argument has been from some folks that has been, well, you know, the Saudis spend a lot of money, and they spend a lot of money for decades. Their relationships in Washington are the same. And OK, they got major arms export increases from the previous administration under the Clinton-led State Department after they put money into the Clinton Foundation. But look, the Saudis have been powerful in Washington forever. I think the way to think about this is there's a few important points. First, oftentimes money is spent in Washington not just to change a policy, but to preserve a policy. This idea that you can only show the potential effect of a moneyed relationship by showing a change in policy is absurd. It costs in many cases, money in Washington to preserve controversial policies. The second thing that's worth mentioning is the lead of our story on the weapons deals dealt with a specific major weapons agreement between the United States, led by the Clinton-led State Department, and the Saudi government. It was a $29 billion arms deal, one of the biggest arms deals between the United States and Saudi Arabia in history. The State Department said it was Clinton's, quote, top priority. And the key point is that the Israelis were raising objections to it. The Israelis, another very powerful force in terms of our diplomatic relationships and the like. That deal, nonetheless, still went through. Now, did it go through because the Saudis were one of the biggest donors to the Clinton Foundation? I have not seen evidence of that. Is it fair to put that timetable together and say, you know, does Saudi money in Washington spent on a foundation linked to the chief regulator of that arms deal, could that money have played some role? I think asking that question is legitimate to ask. And I think asking that question directly to Clinton is legitimate to ask. And I think even more so, it's legitimate to ask more generally, is that the kind of thing that should have gone on? And it's worth mentioning that, of course, the Clintons are now saying that the foundation will effectively be divorced from foreign governments and the like if she is elected president. And the follow-up question to that then becomes, well, if it's not okay for that kind of thing to have happened, to happen when you're president, why was it okay for it to have happened when you were America's chief diplomat overseeing so much business between the United States and these foreign governments who were donating to the foundation? And I have not heard a good answer to that.
No, nor have we.
No.
David, I wonder if you could talk a bit personally about what it's like being an investigative reporter during this election, especially reporting on stories that are critical of Hillary Clinton. You know, Donald Trump is a dangerous, very problematic figure running for office that no sensible person would like him to be president. So it's created this environment where any bit of criticism of Hillary Clinton, you're immediately portrayed as someone who wants to see Donald Trump win. What do you think of that tactic? How does it affect you in your reporting at all?
Well, look, it's certainly a powerful tactic. It's certainly one that's been operationalized and politically weaponized by the Democratic Party and the Clinton campaign. It makes being a journalist, you know, it could be not all that enjoyable at certain times when you're just trying to do your job and report facts and people bring their own politics to it. I mean, I put up a tweet a couple of days ago where we had done a story about, as I mentioned before, Donald Trump giving money to a group linked to Chris Christie, and then Chris Christie's administration reducing Donald Trump's tax bill soon after. And I put up that story and I said, you know, Democrats will scream, this is clearly a quid pro quo. And then on that Trump story, and then the same people will literally scream that a similar story of money going in to the Clinton Foundation or to the Clinton campaign, if you don't have an exact proof of a piece of paper that shows a quid pro quo, it's not a quid pro quo. And what I've been most disappointed by, although certainly not surprised by, is that there certainly is a core group of hardcore politicos, political activists and the like. And I think it's more than just the political professionals. I think at some grassroots level inside the Democratic Party, there is this idea that truth is judged not on its merits, but on whether it helps or hurts Democratic Party candidates. And I think that is something that we've certainly seen with the Fox News on the right and that effect there. But I think we now see it intensely within the Democratic Party itself. And I think that's dangerous. I think that's really dangerous. I mean, it's one thing to have one side of the political divide, Fox Newsified, where, you know, facts are not facts unless they serve the right. But for that to happen on the Democratic side, on the ostensibly left of center side, it really calls into question whether we can, as a country, make decisions based on indisputable facts. Because facts remain facts, whether you like them or not. But if you create a political architecture that says only facts that serve our ends are worthwhile and have merit, that becomes a way to effectively divorce you from reality, and not just divorce you from reality, but also justify the very behavior that for instance, you know, only a month ago or 2 months ago, you were criticizing it. It takes away the credibility of any previous position you had if you're willing to take that position and those facts and then use them in the opposite way when it serves you.
That's a good point. And we've seen that the Democratic Party seems to be sacrificing quite a bit to just win this short-term election here. But David, we're fresh out of time. David Sirota is the senior editor at the International Business Times. You can follow him on Twitter at David Sirota. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Thanks, David.
And that'll do it for Unanimous Dissent today. You can listen to this show and all of our shows by going to the Radio Sputnik website or by checking out our website at www.districtsentinel.com. Subscribe to this show on iTunes by searching for District Sentinel Radio. And stick around for tomorrow's show. We're not going anywhere. We'll stay right here in D.C. so you don't have to be.